is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
Hello, everybody. This is Debbie Powell. I'm the Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne County. And again, things are still a little bit different. We are doing this interview by the magic of Zoom. I have the great opportunity to talk to Sue Mosbacher, who is not only in charge of the Master Food Preserver Program, is also in charge of the Master Gardener Program. So hello, Sue.
Hi, Debbie.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I hope you are doing well too.
I am, and I have a huge suspicion that more people are going to be growing vegetables this summer in their garden.
I hope so.
And I think more people are going to be doing preserving food.
I am so excited about that prospect.
Yes, I think that's going to happen. I'm going to pick on you as far as what are some of the easiest things to preserve that come out of our garden? So I'm going to throw one at you.
Okay.
Are cucumbers and making pickles, is that really a lost art? Is that something only maybe our grandmothers could do, or can we do it now? And do we have to be as smart as our grandmothers?
Kids can do it, and kids are probably smarter than our grandmothers now. But no, it's very easy. The hardest thing is patience, because when you're making traditional cucumber pickles, you want to soak it beforehand, so you have to plan in advance. But it's pretty much slice them up, make a brine, and cook them or process them in a boiling water or a steam canner, and then waiting for the flavor to sit in over 3 weeks or so, and then you've got a delicious cucumber pickle.
You made that sound pretty easy.
It is. Well, and one of the other things you need to remember to do so that you can have a nice crunchy one is you want to pick them as soon as they are ripe, but then cut off the blossom end, because there's some enzymes in there that will make it a soft pickle. And so if you cut off the end, you can have a nice crisp pickle. Cucumber
now,
pickle.
Are there different flavors to making the pickles? I mean, are there different things? Okay.
Yeah, there's a variety of things you can do. One of the easiest things to do is to change the vinegar flavor. You have your traditional white distilled vinegar. I like to use white wine vinegar when I make my pickles. I think it gives it a smoother flavor. You can even go all out for champagne vinegar, which is an even higher acidity and has a different taste. But you need to make sure you have at least a 5% acidity with the vinegar. And then spices. You can find grandma's old recipe, and you can use the spices from her recipe, but not the vinegar, because it used to be long ago that vinegar was 7% acidity, and before that, even longer, it was about 15% acidity. And the big concern when we're making pickles is that we add enough acidity so that the product can be processed in a boiling water or a steam canner. So that way the bad bacteria that we worry about, Clostridium botulinum, won't grow, because it needs a low acid environment. So if we add commercial vinegar to our vegetables, and then we add our spice mixes, we'll have a nice safe product. So you can have your secret recipe for the spice blends to make your own unique pickles.
So I have to ask you, do you have a secret recipe that you can share with us?
No, I do not. There, that's a safe answer, right? But now, one thing to say with those secret spice blend recipes is if you can use fresh dehydrated herbs, and not the old stuff that's been sitting in your cupboard a long time. And if you've got gardeners out there, they're going to have their fresh herbs. But the fresher the herb and then dry it, you want to make sure that you use dried herbs and not fresh herbs. You'll have it bursting with flavor. If you use stale herbs, they go stale.
Ah, that makes sense. One of the things that I learned from attending one of your presentations by Zoom, not in person, you did it by Zoom, is with pickles, since I'm going to be asking about it, not that I've got the experience doing it, you said that you have the option of doing a water bath or a steam canning, and you showed that you could use a pot as long as it's deep enough. Is that true? You can use a big pot.
Yep, you just have to have some kind of rack on the bottom, and you can just take canning rings. If you don't have a rack that fits the size of the pot, you can have canning rings that you can twist tie together with the hard plastic twisty ties. You want to make sure that you keep the jars off the bottom of the canner. You don't want them to be right on the heat source. Plus, when you're canning, the goal is to have the heat go through the jar from the bottom, from the sides of the jars, and the top. And so you need to have water underneath the jar so the heat can come from all sides.
Okay. Now, I think one of the things, and maybe I said a misleading comment, I commented on grandmothers. We really can't use their recipes, can we?
Not the old pickling ones. And a lot of the old recipes that they had have been upgraded in terms of the food safety and the research that's been done. A lot of times our predecessors in the canning world would use paraffin wax, for example, on jams and jellies. It was very easy. You melt the wax, you make your jelly or your jam, you pour the wax over the top. It spreads out over the top of the jar, and as it cools, it seals. And the issue is you haven't processed the product underneath. And with jams and jellies, there's usually, if you follow the recipes right, enough sugar that things won't grow. However, there still could be pathogens in there. And if you haven't killed them through heat processing, they can grow. And also, our grandmas were usually very fortunate to have some kind of a root cellar or a basement where they could keep the jars at an even temperature. I don't have a root cellar. And so my jars might get warmer in the summer, and they might get colder in the winter. And if the paraffin wax gets cold, it's gonna shrink. And then in my house, the ants would find it and they would come to it, or bacteria can get in there. And then when things warm up, it's gonna melt a little bit and expand back out and trap everything inside. And so we don't recommend using paraffin wax. And then we don't recommend what's called open kettle canning. And that's where you take a hot product, you put it in a hot jar with very little headspace, and then you put a lid on it, and the heat kind of forces the air out and it creates a light vacuum seal. Again, the product hasn't been processed. You don't have a sterile environment in there. And so if there's pathogens trapped in there, they could grow. So we always recommend that people do a heat pasteurization to kill any pathogens that are in there so they don't grow. There's too many people out in the world today that have compromised immunosystems, are recovering from cancer, or going through cancer treatments, and we don't want to risk giving them any bacteria that their bodies don't need and can't handle.
No, that's great advice. Now, I've got to ask you about zucchini. Usually there seems to always be an abundance of zucchini. What can we do with that?
Oh my goodness, there's so many things you can do with zucchini. If you're going to be canning, we've already talked about pickling, you can pickle zucchini. You can make bread and butter pickled zucchinis. You can pickle it in cubes. And the nice thing about the zucchini is it absorbs all the flavor. And so depending on the spices, you'll have a different batch each time if you vary the dried spices that you put in there. One of my favorites, I like to take what I call the caveman club zucchinis, where you go away for a weekend and you come back and that 2-inch zucchini is now 2 feet. you peel it, you scoop out all the seeds, and then if you shred it, you can can that with unsweetened pineapple juice, some lemon juice, and a little bit of sugar, and the zucchini absorbs the pineapple flavor, and then you use it in recipes instead of crushed pineapple.
Oh my gosh.
It's delicious. Fabulous.
That is fabulous. Yeah.
And then you can dry it too. One of the things I like to do is I'll take, again, those giant zucchinis and I'll shred them with the skin on, and then I dehydrate them. And so I have shredded dried zucchini. And then I like to make zucchini pancakes or zucchini, it's like a latte. It's the little zucchini pancakes, I guess it would be. Uh-huh. And fritters and things like that. And or I will throw it into a soup, or you can throw it into meatloaf. And then you get some of the vegetable goodness from it. And if you put it in a soup, it will almost disintegrate. And so you can use it as a thickener as well. So you can make that zucchini chips. And you can add different spices and dry them.
So going back to zucchini chips, do you have to cut them very thin and then you lay them flat in your dehydrator? And
yep.
And yep. Do you season them?
You can. And actually, one of the tips I learned from a volunteer was she would put the zucchini chips in a little cookie sheet, and then she would sprinkle the powder on the spice mix. You could use salt, garlic, whatever flavoring you want. And then she'd flip them all over, a little time consuming, and then she'd sprinkle it again. But she found that if she just put them in a bag and then sprinkled the spice seasons on them and tried to mix them all around, she didn't get a very even distribution of the flavoring on the chips. And so she found by laying them out one at a time, it worked great. And then she'd put them on her dehydrator tray, or you could put the dehydrator tray on the cookie tray. But that way she didn't use a baggie method where she just shake and get it on there, right. But she spread them out and put it on both sides. But you do want to have them cut thin, about a 16th of an inch, and you want to be as even as possible, because otherwise the thinner ones are going to dry first. You're going to have to pick them out and then put them back in the dehydrator. So if you've got them all the same size, they should all dry evenly and you only have to take them out once.
So maybe using a mandolin might be helpful.
Mandolins are fabulous tools for that.
Okay. And I have to admit, I was really scared of them because they just look scary to me. But boy, they sure cut down the time on slicing. And with that guard, if, of course, everybody's using the guard, then they're pretty safe, it seems like.
Yeah. That's the key thing is paying attention when you're doing it and using the guard. You can also buy those gloves that protect your fingers when you're working with knives.
Good
idea. But the
biggest
thing is paying attention.
Right. Mm-hmm. Paying attention to what you're doing and don't get distracted and that kind of stuff. That's a lot of things you can do with zucchini. And of course, you can always use zucchini fresh. We can't forget about that.
Yeah. And you can freeze it.
Now, how do you freeze zucchini?
Most of the time people will freeze it shredded, so that way they can add it to zucchini bread and zucchini pancakes later. And so you want to make sure it's not damp when you put it in the freezer. And so you're going to pat it dry with a paper towel. As weird as it sounds, if I have something like that, I'll take a hair dryer on low and I'll blow it over to get the extra moisture off, and then put it in an airtight container, get as much air out as you can, stick it in the freezer. And you want to make sure you get rid of the air, because freezer burn, those ice crystals, they happen when the moisture that's naturally in the food evaporates. And if there's air for it to evaporate into, then it gets out into the air and then it freezes. So if you get rid of as much air as possible in your packaging, you really reduce the potential for freezer burn.
Ah, that is great advice. Well, Sue, I hate to tell you, but we've run out of time. But if they want to get more information about how to preserve food, you guys have a wonderful store of information on your website, and that's on the Central Sierra website, under Master Food Preservers. In fact, if you just go to the homepage of Central Sierra, and everybody, you know, you can Google that. It's really easy. I do it all the time. There's little pictures showing all the different programs, and there's a picture of the Master Food Preservers. You click on that. That goes right into your page. Same with the Master Gardeners. There's a little picture there, and you can get all the information that way. So I want to thank you so much, Sue, and we'll talk again.
Great. Thank you for having me on the show, Debbie.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. This isn't a long presentation, but we're going to talk about lawn replacement, because it's such a it's such a tool for having a really big impact on lowering your water use. This is what my wife and I did at our house a number of years ago. As you can tell, our lawn wasn't real stellar anyway. The topsoil wasn't, we never put enough topsoil in, and we've got a lot of clay material underneath that's basically decomposed slate. And the gophers are just through everything. So we decided, the heck with it, since all of our irrigation is off the well anymore, and with the weather getting more drought years being more prevalent, we decided to heck with it. Let's see what kind of a reduction we can make in our water use by taking this 900 square feet of lawn and a couple of plants out. So go ahead to the next slide. So we rented a sod cutter and with a shovel and soaked it down, and we took all the sod out and some of the plants along the side. But we kept the sprinkler system in. You can see one stub there and another stub there, and these are hard to see. They're probably buried still. But so we took all of the lawn out, and you can see that this just is gently sloping. So we decided the first thing we have to do is we want to contour this before we do anything else. Next slide. So we brought in a lot of sandy soil, and we mixed it with some of our compost and more loamy soil. And we did all of our contouring with new soil on top of that original clay soil. And while we were at it, we were starting to put in some walks. We have three lids on our septic tank right down here, so we had to put that under a walk. So next time we have to get at it, we can pull bricks out, put bricks back. Next slide. And this is after we got most of the contouring in when we the way we liked it. So it's undulating enough, so whether it's from, it probably won't be from irrigation because everything's under drips, but when it's raining hard, there are enough pockets and enough undulations that the water will sit there and tend to soak in before it runs off. And that was the whole intent behind the whole concept, is to make better use of rainwater. And since we're kind of rock hounds anyway, we bring rocks back from everywhere. So in our gardens, the rocks are as much part of the landscape as the plants are. And some people think we're nuts, but that's the way it is. And then when we were doing this too, all these stakes in here, we were already buying plants. And so we were deciding what plants we wanted where based on the size, the color. I've learned also to don't really put a lot of stock into the maximum size they say the plant's gonna get, because if you let it, it'll usually get much bigger. Anyway, next slide. And this is on the other end, same kind of thing going in. Next slide, Debbie. And this is after the first fall planting, and we just got the mulch in on this too. So all of this is underneath this mulch is, it's kind of hard to see it now, but it's all undulating, so it tends to catch a lot more water. And then we've got most of our rocks in here. And then next slide. And then this is after 4 years of growth. And you can see some of the mistakes we made on putting this rock rose, you know, too close to for some very small plants. We tried to put the bigger plants down the middle and the smaller plants towards the walkways, and it didn't always turn out that way. Or we can blame it on ourselves for not dead-ending enough and not pruning enough too. So sometimes it's our fault. Anyway, that's what it looks like. And when a lot of these things are in bloom, it's really terrific, and it's so much, except for the dead-ending and the pruning, it's much less than maintenance.
What do you do with the old sod?
With the old sod?
Is there any good use for it?
We put it as at the side of our driveway to kind of widen it out a little bit and built it up on the side. So we use it for fill.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Great. And our sod, we didn't want to move it anyplace and reuse it because our lawn quality was really poor. Yes.
When you removed the sod, you said there was that clay. You busted up the clay and mixed it a little bit with the, or did you, when you brought in the soil amendments?
The clay was already pretty well busted up. The ridge that we live on is the geology of the ridge. It's out of slate. It's a metamorphosed shale. And where it decomposes at the surface, it breaks down very rapidly. So it breaks down into some really fine sands and silts. And there are enough fractures in the slate that there's still a lot of penetration through it. So we didn't have to bust up the clay much. We just put the soil over the top, and it still penetrates.
Really. The clay was on top of the shale?
No, or the clay is part of the shale. It's part of the decomposed process. When the slate decomposes, it breaks down into the shale components, which are primarily clay and very fine silts.
I noticed you didn't use any weed cloth. Is there any role for weed cloth in a project like that?
If you have like a really onerous grass, like Bermuda grass or something like that, that's mm-hmm. down several feet, the weed cloth will probably help. Actually, at the demonstration garden, we used newspaper and cardboard, and that worked really well. Mm-hmm. But what we did on this garden is, the only thing we did is, after we stripped it, we gave it like two different sprays of Roundup. We used Roundup on that, and we had very few lawn weeds coming back. But a lot of these plants, most of these plants do really well, but we found that we planted a few of them in the wrong place because they got too darn big. But you can see how some of the plants got. This rock rose right here is big enough. It's got about two larger drips on it, where it started out with one half gallon per hour drip.
You mentioned you used a sod cutter. What is that? How does it work?
It's between two wheels and an axle, and it's got a camshaft on it. Run off the motor that runs a little plate that vibrates back and forth.
You just sort of slice it?
Yeah, it slices it, and it's a little flat plate, actually. It's sharp along one edge, and it'll just oscillate back and forth, and you just kind of let it slice and don't push it too hard. But you have to go through and really soak it down, because if you don't, it'll break the pin on that holds the shear pin that holds the whole shaft assembly together. Okay, next slide.
Did you experience that or something?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. After we put this in, we replaced 900 square feet of lawn, and we had about 80 or 85 plants, I think. 80 plants, I think. Yeah. I looked at the sprinklers that we were using. And we were using these Hunter sprinkler heads, pop-ups. And the quantity of water with the pressure we were using, I calculated back, and we were using about 1,400 gallons a week to water that lawn.
Whoa.
And then after we put 80 plants in, all the gopher cages, all the irrigation stuff, going through all the calculations on it, we got it down to 225 gallons per week, so it's 84% savings. That is meaningful. So after we did that, we liked it so much. We liked the looks of it. We liked the fact that we're using less well water. We decided to do a big patch on the other side of the house, so that we'll look at that next. These were the sprinklers that we were using. All we did was dig down, pull the sprinkler off, and then we just put a male adapter on it and a length of pipe, and then on top of it we put a drip head. And then we had 11 sprinklers, and we've got 10 of them are taken up by these drip heads. And we chose the heads that will water 8 plants. And then you can adjust the quantity of water on the top, or we just use them wide open, turn them wide open, and then we adjust the water quality or water quantity by the drip emitter that we put on the plants. So we always know what we're using. And then there are several of these risers that'll have a T and a plug in it. And that T and the plug,
or you can make them.
That's what we screw this into to be able to plug the hose in from the from the rainwater tank.
Oh.
So that's how we water the drip system. Next slide. Okay, we're on the other side of the house now. We still have some lawn around the fruit trees, but we took the lawn out from here over to the right, and then we went around this fruit tree. Now, next slide. And we went around this oak tree, and we took all this lawn out back here. Some of the lawn back here was really terrible. Next slide. And then all of this lawn in here came out, and you can see how fine this lawn was. So we didn't lose much there. Next slide. And this is kind of all stages of removal and planting at the same time. The piece of ground I'm standing on here is all mulched, and the plants were in a couple of months before. And right here, we're in the process of bringing soil in. You can see the new soil here. And the rocks are going in, and these plants are going in. What held up the whole progress of the whole thing is how fast we can make the damn gopher cages. So, and that was not fun. Anyway, and then this part of it, you've got the plants are in, and actually we're getting some mulch. Next slide.
Al, did you have to go steal some more rocks, or did you have these in reserve?
Every time we go camping, we you think you're going to come back lighter from the camping trip? Because you drank all the beer and all the wine and everything else and ate all the food. But we're usually 200 or 300 pounds heavier every time because we bring rocks back.
What's your best mulch that you use? Is it wood chips or?
We just use the wood chips, and we get it up at Garber Lumber off of Tuolumne Road. And they have a wood chip pile up there that's huge for like $21 a yard.
So, but you don't use that in the vegetable garden?
No. In the vegetable garden, what I'll do is usually get a bale of wheat straw, and because it has very few weeds in it, and then I'll take little wafers off that bale and I'll put it in a garbage can and weed eat it until it's all busted up, and then we'll use the straw for mulch in the veggie garden, and it's easier to use that way. So anyway, again, just kind of all stages of getting that. And next slide, Debbie.
Those are some pretty big rocks to put in your
yeah.
Yeah, a lot of them we had to use a hand truck to roll in there. And again, this is all finished, but we're just getting the mulch on this part of it. Mulch is left to go here. And we learned a few things on this part of the garden too, that we spaced some of the plants a little farther apart, so they didn't start encroaching on each other like they did on the other side.
So, Al?
Yeah.
You don't have a problem, or didn't have a problem with like the soil washing down onto the path?
Not really. We have more problems with the birds coming in here after the mulch is on, and the birds are always scratching and looking for bugs. And the brick path is half covered with mulch, so you can, you know, if it really bugs you, you got to come down there about once a week and do it. It'll all be back the next week. So, next slide, David. And this is results after 3 years of growth. And so, it's some of the plants grew really fast and really big. And it's a wide variety of plants. And then to the left of this, we have a cactus garden over on this to the left side.
You know what you could do with your rock? Could paint the name of the plants on them.
Yeah.
Sure. I just thought about that, that flat one there.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty cool.
It was funny. When we were in the actually it was before we started this site, I think was when our house was on that tour.
The garden tour.
And one of the gals and the master gardeners, they go through before the tour and they take their people on the team, they write down all the plants and have little signs on what the plants are and everything else. And I gave them a sheet of for the rocks, because you got to tell what the rocks are, too. And I think, I won't say who it was, but she said, oh, we're not going to worry about that. And then Richard piped up. He said, yeah, we are. We're making signs for these too, so they found out that we're a little bit strange because the rocks are as much a part of our landscape as the plants are. Next slide. That's it for that.